Let's get to some leftover questions tonight. There are several of them that will not take very long to understand. What did Jesus look like? Physical appearance, like modern Easterners today. Well, I'm not sure what Easterners look like today in this metropolitan world in which we live. The ethnicity of individuals is not as divided geographically as it once was. You know, what does an American look like? It would be almost like saying that. And there was a time when you could ask what an American looked like, and the answer would have been like a Cherokee Indian or a Choctaw or Seminole. But he looked like the Easterners of his day, physical appearance. And what he looks like, we don't know. There is one verse in the Bible, and look in Isaiah chapter 53. As far as I know, this is the one passage of scriptures in the Bible that describes what Jesus looked like. And there is that prophecy about Jesus. We call this the Messianic chapter. And here is the statement of him in verse 2. He shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of the dry ground. That talks about the origin of Jesus. And then he says, and he has no form or comeliness. And when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. So what did it look like? Totally unlike the paintings that have come out of the Middle Ages. You know, that Jesus is always handsome and always has great beauty and everything. And yet the Bible says he was just ordinary. In fact, there is no form. I have a marginal reading on the word form, and that is the word splendor. There's this grandeur that he did not have, or comeliness. And I've got a marginal reading there, which means no appearance. And when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. And so that concept of being stately form and of him having splendor and having an appearance, there's just nothing attractive about him. So whenever you see the paintings of Jesus you may have pictures in your Bible sometimes, you'll see them on television, he does not look like a movie star. And what he looks like, he looked like the individuals that were there in that day, and perhaps very much like the Jewish people that are there today, especially those who have retained their ethnicity. And that would come about because of the fact that Jews did not marry out, or even today oftentimes did not marry outside of Judaism. Here's an interesting one. Does or did God recognize the divorce allowed by Moses? That's in Matthew chapter 19, but David will also get ready to put Mark chapter 10 up there. But in Matthew chapter 19, they came to Jesus and asked him a question. And the question that they asked him was to get him in trouble. Not an honest question. These are not individuals who've come to try to get Jesus to really answer their question. Verse 3 says, they came testing him, saying, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife just for any reason? That's a legitimate question. And Jesus answered that not with a yes or no, but by quoting scriptures. And that's why he says in verse 4, he said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? It's interesting how Jesus answers the question by saying, go read the Bible. Which in and of itself is an affirmation that you'd understand the Bible. And so he says, did you not read, he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. That's the New King James. Does that answer your question? Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Jesus says that God said, leave your father and mother and cleave to your wife. And the word cleave here means to be glued. It's almost, if they'd had super glue in Bible times, it's that kind of glue that the Greek indicates. It's a very interesting word. Let him be attached to his wife. And then Jesus' conclusion is, God has joined them together, and only God can separate them. Let not man separate. They said, why did Moses command to give a certificate of divorcement and to put her away? And Jesus said, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but that was not so from the beginning. And so he again goes back to the beginning and said, here's God's original plan. But when Moses comes along, there was a hardness of heart, so people would not leave, would not abide by what God said, and so they made provisions about that. Now, unlike that which is commonly believed, Moses did not allow divorce for every cause. We'll not look at Deuteronomy chapter 24, but Moses says there's one reason you can divorce your wife. It was the Jews who'd come up with a Jewish idea that's like the modern idea, and that is, if you're not happily married, then just go ahead and separate. It'd be all right. You know, you have a right to be happy. Well, that was a popularly held idea, but Jesus said only God can put asunder that which God joined together. And so in Deuteronomy 24, the reason Moses gave was a matter of uncleanness. The marginal reading there is nakedness. It has something to do with sexual impurity. And then he says, but it wasn't true that way from the beginning. Now, based on what Moses said in Deuteronomy chapter 24, that you can put her away for a matter of nakedness, the Jews had arrived at the fact that you could put her away for every reason. And that we're not going to spend much time looking at that other than to point out the fact that the Jews have done a better job of telling people their view of Old Testament divorce than Moses did. That's not the way I want to say that. People have attached themselves to what the Jews said about it's all right to put away your wife for every cause, when Moses said only for a matter of nakedness. But the question is, and that's what we want to focus on, did God recognize this? Look in Mark chapter 10, verse 3. Whenever they said in verse 2, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife, divorce his wife, testing him? He answered and said, what did Moses command you? Deuteronomy chapter 4 is not just Moses sort of freelancing out on his own. This is a commandment that came from God. Moses was a prophet of God. And so when he says, what did Moses command you? You need to understand Moses wasn't just sort of freelancing it out there, that Moses made a provision that God was not a part of. It was a command from God. And they answer the question in verse 4, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorcement and to dismiss her. Jesus answered and said to them, because of the hardness of your heart, he wrote you this precept. So there are two words used to refer to Deuteronomy chapter 24. One is command, and the word is precept. Where did that precept come from? Where did that command come from? It came from God. And so, of course, God recognized those individuals who put away their mate for the reason of Deuteronomy chapter 24. Not that Moses allowed divorce for every cause, and so he loosened it up so that everybody could put away their mate. Deuteronomy 24 says, for a matter of nakedness. Here's an interesting one that's been turned in. Why don't we sing with musical instruments? Well, the answer to that is both simple and it is complex also, in a sense, because it has to do with the nature of authority. You and I need to understand that we have authority to do that which God commands. Look at Colossians chapter 3 and verse 17 that says, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means whatever you do, do it because there is authority from the Lord to do that. Do you have Bible authority to kiss your wife? Thank you, Joe. Do you have Bible authority to kiss somebody else's wife? You understand? Where does the Bible say thou shalt not kiss somebody else's wife? Well, you and I need to understand that God gives positive commands, and where God gives positive commands or implies things that are a part of the will of God, that in and of itself prohibits without the negative statement that is there. Let's see. Think about Noah building the ark. Genesis chapter 6, God came and he told Noah about the building of the ark. And he said, you shall make an ark of gopher wood. Noah, what authority do you have to build that ark? Well, I have the commandment of God. If you're going to do what God said, do you have authority to use gopher wood? Well, of course you do. Now, wait a minute. Noah, don't you understand with all those smelly animals that's going to be in the ark, that if you would take your apartment that you and Mrs. Noah go to sleep in, if you'll line that with cedar, it'll smell a whole lot better. It'll be a whole lot more fitting for you if you'll make it pleasant for you, putting cedar in the ark. Do you have authority for that? Absolutely not. Well, where did God ever say, thou shalt not use cedar? Never said it, except when God authorizes doing something, that is the authority for doing that. Take the Lord's Supper. Suppose somebody said, this unleavened bread is pretty good, but you know, it's rather tasteless. And so I believe that we ought to add something on top of the unleavened bread. And just so that it will appeal to our young people, we're going to put peanut butter and jelly on top of that communion bread. It will have more appeal. Or we will have unleavened bread, but on top of that we'll put some of the icing from Krispy Kreme donuts. Where does the Bible say thou shalt not use peanut butter and jelly in the Lord's Supper? Where does the Bible say thou shalt not use sugar icing on the Lord in the Lord's Supper? Well, it doesn't say it. Thou shalt not. But if you're going to do whatever you do in the name of the Lord, the only authority you have is unleavened bread. The only authority you have is to have fruit of the vine in the Lord's Supper. And so when God gives positive commands, the very nature of that command negates using anything that is not authorized. Now, there is generic authority. Noah, do you have authority to use a hammer? Oh, yes. What are you going to do? Well, I'm going to use a hammer, and you have authority. Yes, God said to make an ark. And so when God says make an ark, that authorizes the carrying out of that in a generic way. He didn't specifically mention a hammer, but he says build an ark, make an ark of gopher wood. And that in and of itself authorizes the carrying out of the command. It's like the matter of the songbook. You know, is there authority to use a songbook in our worship? Absolutely. Well, where's the authority? Well, in order to sing, and there needs to be music, and in order to sing, there needs to be words. And so the carrying out of that command, the carrying out of it, authorizes in some way having words and having music. There's generic authority for that. Is there authority to project them on the screen? Absolutely. Why? It's a part of carrying out God's command of speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs and singing and making melody in your hearts to the Lord. And so when it comes to the matter of instrumental music, people make all kinds of arguments about, well, it was used in the Old Testament. Absolutely. It was used in heaven. Absolutely. In the figurative language of the book of Revelation. But the question is not what did Moses do or what will happen in heaven. The question is, what does God authorize? Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. Instrumental music in the Old Testament, the harps mentioned as being in heaven, but that has nothing at all to do. There are horses in the Old Testament and there are horses in heaven. Does that authorize us bringing horses into our worship? You see, just because it's mentioned in some place, what does he authorize us to do in relationship to the matter of instrumental music? And somebody says, well, we ought to use every talent that the Lord has to us, has for us. Well, is that the authority for the for instrumental music? Well, what about other talents that you might have? What about that church in Dallas that converted a woman who was a striptease dancer, and on a Sunday service, she gave her God-given natural ability to strip and praise God by showing the talent that she had. What about dancing in worship? Not authorized. You and I need to understand that whatever we do, we need to do it in the name of the Lord. We could spend a lot of time on that. In fact, in an upcoming Sunday morning sermon, I'm going to deliver a lesson that I presented 25 years ago in the old building over there. I haven't preached it since that time, and I think I'll just preach it again in relationship to that. Why do we not have instruments of music in worship? Well, here's the best reason. There's not Bible for it. There's not any Bible for it. There's not specific authority, nor is there generic authority. And therefore, whatever we do in word or deed, we're going to do all in the name of the Lord. What exactly is going to be in the book of life? Well, look in Revelation chapter 20. I'm assuming that's what's going to be there. I'm not sure what the questioner has in mind whenever he says, what is in the book of life? Revelation chapter 20, there is that great description of the judgment. Put verse 11 through verse 15 on the screen, David. I saw a great white throne, and he who sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heavens fled away, found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And so the questioner is, exactly what is going to be in the book of life? And the dead were judged according to their works by the things written in, not in the book of life. Look at the S on the word book there. You see the S there? What written in the books. The sea gave up the dead that were in it. Death and Hades delivered up the dead that were in them. And they were judged, every man according to his words. Then death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. Something was written in the book of life. And the ones who are not found written in the book of life are going to go to hell. Look back in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 5. He says, you have a few names, verse 4, you have a few names in Sardis who have not defiled the garments, and they shall walk with me in heaven in white, for they are worthy. He that overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life. You see that? What's in the book of life? Well, there are some names that have been there that have been blotted out, which in and of itself shows the fallacy of the doctrine, once saved, always saved. Here were names written in the book of life of those who are redeemed, and if they're not blotted out, they're going to go to heaven. But here are names that have been blotted out. What's written in the book of life? The names of those who are going to go to heaven. Look in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, about starting in verse 22 and going through verse 23. But ye have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, And the Mount Zion he has in mind is set in contrast in previous verses to the fact that some came to Mount Sinai and there they heard the voice of God and God shook the earth but with his voice. But he says, you have not come to that mountain, you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God. You've come to the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. You have come, listen to this, to the assembly, the general assembly, and the church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. And I believe the old King James has the word written there. He says, you have come to the church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. Is there a registry in heaven? Oh, yes. It's a book of life that has in it the names of those who are going to go to heaven. And he says, that is what you have come to. But pause long enough to point out the fact that in this verse, the word firstborn is modified by the plural verb are. You've come to the church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. That is a reflection, by the way, of the fact that the word firstborn here does not refer to Jesus, though Jesus was a firstborn, but so are all of the redeemed of God. And so the word firstborn in the Greek here is in the plural. You have come to the assembly of the firstborn ones. And these firstborn ones are registered in heaven. You see, when one becomes a Christian, his name is registered in heaven, and on the final day, that registry will be opened. Some names will have been removed from that registry, and that's what's in the book of life. If there's more to the book of life than that, I'm not aware of any verse in the Bible that indicates that. I've heard that 400 B.C. to 1 A.D., there's silence in the Bible, no passages, no words from God. Is this true? Why are 400 years missing? Well, to answer that question, I think about a young boy who was, well, not so young, a young adult, who turned to his fiancée-to-be and says, will you marry me? And she says, yes. And he just sat there and sat there. And she said, aren't you going to say anything else? He said, I think I've said all I need to say. You know why there are 400 silent years before the end of the book of, from the book end of the book of Revelation to the beginning of the New Testament? Because God had said everything he needed to say. Got to get that. Why there are other times whenever there are very few prophets. If there are other times when there may be no prophets. That we know of, anyway. Why? Because God didn't have a message to be given. And when God has given the fullness of His message, you start in the book of Genesis and go through the book of Malachi, and God has said everything He needs to say. What more can He say than that which He has already said? Really, it may be a little bit more than 400 years between the end of Malachi, Malachi chapter 4 and verse 6, and Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1. Maybe more than 400 years. So 400 silent years, and they're silent only in the sense that God had said everything He needed to say. Now, what happened during that 400 silent years? God foretold in the book of Daniel some of the things that would happen. Look in the book of Daniel, and you'll see prophecies that are made in the book of Daniel that concerns the 400 silent years. In Daniel chapter 2, there is an image that Daniel sees. And Daniel explains, beginning in verse 36, the meaning of this image. Without going into detail about the image, you can read that some other time. But in verse 36, Daniel says, "This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom and power and strength. And wherever the children of men dwell, the beast of the field and the birds of the heaven, he's given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them. You are the head of gold." In the image, there was an image that the king had seen, and the head of it was gold. And Daniel said, "Nebuchadnezzar, that's you." Then he says, "After you shall arise another kingdom." What happened after Babylon fell? Well, another kingdom arose inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom made of bronze, which shall rule over the earth. We're not just talking about kings, we're talking about kingdoms. And so whenever he says, "Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold," he's talking about the Babylonians. And he says, "Then there will arise another kingdom." That's how we know it's not just a list of kings. It's another kingdom. And it'll not be as great as you are. Gold is more precious than silver. And that's why in the image it was made of silver. Then says, "A third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth." What are we talking about? Kingdoms that rule over all the earth. Now the Bible tells us the name of that kingdom that overthrew the head of gold. And so in the 66 books of the Old Testament, we know that the kingdom that followed that was the Medes and the Persians. Daniel chapter 5 tells about the very night that the Babylonian kingdom fell, and Darius the Mede, verse 31 of chapter 5, received the kingdom. So there's that kingdom that Darius or Darius was ruler over, and that's the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. Now, it's during the time of the Medes and the Persians, the Jews come back from Babylon and come back to the Promised Land. And when they arrive back in the Promised Land, the last three books of the Old Testament are written. The books being Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And so after they come back from Babylonian captivity, there are three prophets. And when we get to the end of those three prophets, that's the end of the divinely inspired written books that were written concurrently with the events that were happening. But Daniel says there is to be another kingdom, a third kingdom that is to arise. Look in Daniel chapter 8. The imagery is changed. This time it's not the imagery of an idol, but it is the imagery of animals. One being a goat and the other one being a ram. And he says in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 20, "The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of the Medes and Persians." Now we're back to this imagery again. And he mentions that kingdom that was after Babylon, the Medes and the Persians. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. Well, when did that happen? It happened during those 400 silent years. And so God's told what was going to happen during the time of the 400 silent years, and he'd already told what was going to happen. Daniel chapter 8 mentions Alexander the Great. We know his name. He's not specifically called by name. But it says when Alexander the Great died, that great kingdom would be divided into four parts. That's in Daniel chapter 8. God told what was going to happen in those 400 silent years, and he specified the king or the kingdom. He told of this great king that would arise and of the death of that king. He also talked about what would happen from those four kings. And Daniel chapter 8 talks about some of those things. Look in Daniel chapter 11, in beginning in verse 1. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia. And so we got not only the description of the kings that were there from the time of Alexander the Great, but even a description of the kings that were going to happen. We don't have time to talk about Daniel, this chapter, verse 5, almost through the, well, verse 5 through the end of this chapter. But in chapter 11, verse 5, he mentions the king of the north who becomes strong. He mentioned also the king of the south. Verse 9 mentions the king of, verse 5 mentions the king of the south, and verse 9 mentions the king of the north. And in Daniel chapter 11, he talks about battles that are going on between the king from the north and the kingdom from the south. Guess when all of that was fulfilled? It was fulfilled in the year 250 B.C. all the way up almost to the time of the New Testament. God prophetically told what was going to happen during the 400 silent years. And so the Bible is not silent in the sense that God did not tell what was going to happen. There is prophetically a divine record of all of the things that were going to happen. And you and I need to understand and appreciate the reason there were no prophets during that 400 silent years is God had given them everything they needed to know to be in a right relationship with God. The same question is, why are there not prophets on this earth today? Why at the end of the New Testament? Why don't we have New Testament books written in the 2nd century A.D. or the 3rd or the 4th or the 6th or the 8th? You know, why do we not have ongoing prophets today? Because when you get to the end of the New Testament, God has given us everything that pertains to our life and to our godliness. Well, if that's true of the New Testament, make that same application. When you get to the end of the book of Malachi, God had given them everything that pertained to their life and everything that pertained to their righteousness. We do have a divine inspired description of what was going to happen, of the arising of the kings from Babylon to the Medes and the Persians to the Greeks, and then finally to the Romans. And Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44 says, during the days of these kings, when that fourth kingdom has arisen, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. Who was ruling on this earth when Jesus came? Oh, the Romans. And the Bible said that in the days of these kings, that includes the Roman kings, that when the Roman kings arrive, God will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. You know what that is? That's the church. So Daniel chapter 2 describes that image and starts in 600 or about 600 B.C. and goes all the way up to the day of Pentecost when the Lord established that. There's divine history prophetically about what was going to happen. There's detailed description prophetically about what was going to happen, mentioning by name the Medes and the Persians and the Greeks, and then mentions a fourth kingdom when the church would be established by God. And there's Daniel chapter 11 that talks about an ongoing battle that had you lived during that period of 200 to, you know, 150 B.C., 250 B.C. to 150 B.C., you could have sat there and read about the king of the north, which would have been up in Syria, and the king of the south, which would have been Egypt, and all of the interface that went between those kingdoms, even down to the fact there'd be a marriage between the daughter of the queen of the south and the queen of the north, or perhaps it was the daughter of the queen of the north and the king of the south. And so you've got it down to those great details. Great questions tonight. I hope you've enjoyed this. Let's now have that song of invitation. Are you ready to give your life to the Lord?